Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to episode 90 of the Bulak Podcast. I'm Ursula Lindsay, and with me as usual is my co-host, Marsha Linksqualey. Hi, Marsha.
Hey, Ursula.
Marsha is in Rabat, and I am in Amman. And we are back after a bit of a summer hiatus to talk about some of the books that we enjoyed over this break and some of the books that we're looking forward to reading this fall. It feels like it's been quite a break, like quite a while, actually, quite a summer.
Yeah, it has been a very long and in some ways, for me, grueling summer. And I'm happy to be in the fall.
Yeah. Well, almost. I mean, technically, it still feels here in Jordan, it still feels and is, I guess, summer. It's pretty hot. And in my travels over the summer, I was in some places also that were pretty hot. I think that's been a lot of people's experience this year, and unfortunately is going to continue to be now. But as I traveled around, I did have the pleasure of managing to pick up or receive a few books, including when I went to the States. And one of the books that I was really excited to get, I think we were both really excited to get, is the new translation of poetry by the Egyptian poet and writer Iman Mersel, The Threshold, which has been translated by Robin Creswell.
Yes, extremely excited. And it brings together work from all four of Iman's extant collections and selections from those in Robin Creswell's really excellent translation, which I spent some time reading them against both the original and some of the poems, not all of them, and against Khaled Matawa's earlier translations that appeared in These Are Not Oranges, My Love. And I think, I don't know to what extent Iman worked with him on these translations, but I know it was a long process and the book has come out so beautifully.
He says in the introduction, he thanks her for having spent a lot of time working with him on the translations. So I think it was a back and forth. And like you say, that comes through. And we should say that we had an episode, we had Mersel on the show in a previous episode to discuss her book, In the Footsteps of Inayat Izayet, which was an extraordinary, beloved book that came out a few years ago that is a work of prose. And it was an award-winning, really groundbreaking book that talked about, was a sort of her investigation and her pursuit of the story of another woman writer from a previous generation. And so I recommend also, if you're interested in her, listening to that episode. Mersel is, she's an academic, she's a translator, she's a writer, she's a poet, and she's always been a poet, from her youth, in Egypt. And she belongs to more or less, I guess, what's called the 90s generation of Egyptian writers. Which, as Creswell explains very, very well in his introduction, were writers that sort of came of age at a time of, I think, disillusionment with a lot of the political certainties and historical processes of the previous decades. And she has really pursued a path of her own.
Yes, sometimes the 90s generation is the sort of thing that people talk about is that distinguishes it is the difference between, you know, this, the sort of generation of committed literature and then this like being a very personal literature. But I think that that is kind of very facile. And I think what you find in all of Immen's writing is this incredible weaving together of the personal with a larger picture.
Yes, yes. I mean, there's a wonderful and enjoyable sort of skepticism and irony and questioning of a lot of, you know, received wisdom and nationalist rhetoric. And then also there's a vein of feminism of a woman's point of view in a male dominated literary scene. I think that's definitely there. And there's this focus on the daily and the personal, but like really, really elevated in this. I mean, it's sort of hard to capture what's so unique about her style. Maybe we should read one of her poems. The title poem is in a way tells the story of her generation, of her own development as a poet. It is a bit about the sort of turning points in her milieu, I would say.
All right. So if it's all right, then I will read The Threshold. It's true. The conductor's bow tie, like arrowheads pointing at each other, has already begun to droop, and we never saw the musician's fingers, though we watched them exit one by one. We knew the early arriving poets had a thing for the flute, despite its complete and utter sadness, and made a point of smoking during intermissions. None of that interested us. What we wanted to see was the black curtain falling over the stage. We were late, just in time to see the fancy people reclaiming their overcoats. The mood was more or less oppressive, like a military barracks when you're forced to sing the national anthem. Although, of course, if this were a foreign film, it would be raining. We didn't mind that the concert was over, and instead of unraveling the denouement from the other shore, we simply walked across the bridge, saluting a man selling party hats just coming back from the Moulid of Hussein. It's true. I was separated from the others by a parade of camels emerging from the Arab League. When we found each other again, we offered our cigarettes to a security guard who didn't know the name of the building he guarded and finally arrived at a bar in the heart of the city, having broadened our horizons and earned a few scratches. We had to sit there 4 years, so we read Samir Amin and Egyptianized Henry Miller, and Kundera gave us new ways to justify adultery. It was there we received a letter from a friend living in Paris, who told us that he'd discovered inside himself a different person from the one he'd always known, and that he was dragging his misery behind him over sidewalks much softer than third world sidewalks, and going to pieces rather comfortably. And so for several months, we were envious of him and wished they would exile us as well to some foreign city. We didn't panic when our money ran out, because one of us had become a Sufi, and after he offered up a short prayer, there opened beneath our feet, I swear to God, a well full of beer, whereupon we behaved like people who've lost their minds, creating a private dictionary with words like Rewish, Hanini, Awaq, Deneshin, etc. We screamed very loudly and were understood by no one. When the oldest of us suggested that we become more forward-thinking, I conceived of a way to convert public toilets into stalls for weeping and public squares into urinals. And then all of a sudden, one of the long-serving intellectuals screamed at his friend, "When I'm talking about democracy, you shut the hell up." So we ran for it until we could catch our breath on Moyes Street, where we met a martyr with a frown who we reassured that he was actually alive and could go on begging if he wanted, and also that there hadn't been a war in the first place. It's true. we were about to nail down our relationship to metaphysics when one of us began covering his skull with an elaborate hat, making us all look like tourists, so that the spice vendor chased after us, saying over and over, "Manehi, wait! For the sake of the prophet, wait!" There was nowhere else to go but the City of the Dead. We stayed there another year, wondering about the smell of guava, and when I decided to leave them all behind and walk alone, I was already 30.
There's just so many things that I love about this poem.
Yeah, okay, so that poem reminds me of how, like, what a portrait of Egypt she paints in this collection as well. You know, how you can just feel yourself walking on the streets throughout this collection.
Yeah, and it's so, I mean, there's such a sort of rich interplay there between the personal and the collective and the historic and the intimate. She just packs it so full, and it has this humor, and it has this, you know, honesty. I think, again, Creswell in his introduction says that she takes herself as a terrain for exploration, but in a way that's like, you know, always, I think, a bit skeptical even of herself, always, you know, looking for the truth, but sort of admitting that maybe the truth can't be found, you know, exposing herself, but, you know, telling you also, like, you know, this is just one version of the facts of me. And it has this simplicity, the seeming simplicity that actually is like extremely complex.
I often feel also that throughout this, she's like going along, sort of tipping over statues as she goes, you know,
right?
Like taking down these kind of sacred cows of Arabic poetry and of just generally of discourse.
Right. I mean, so there's poems, you know, that talk about the state and poems that talk about love demystifying, provocative way. And because this book collects four collections, I think those are the earlier work. And then after she emigrated to Canada, you know, other themes emerged too. The theme of being an immigrant and being far from home becomes something that she writes about a lot. Again, without like any romanticizing.
Yeah, I also loved how her sort of poetic friends continue to appear in the collection. Yasser Abdel Latif, Osama Denasori, Ahmed Yamani, more that I'm not thinking of in the moment, but how her kind of fellow traveler, irreverent travelers of poetry also come up in this collection, that sometimes it feels almost like a collective effort. There's one, an email from Osama Denasori, and she refers to all these other poets and their work and conversations with them as well.
Yeah, that's, I think, the feeling that you get is that she's in sort of mental and emotional conversation with other figures, with other poets, with people in her life. And that she's sort of like the working through these relationships and these exchanges in the poems.
Yeah, sometimes when you read certain works that I think she maybe is referred to as mythology, you know, these big poetic works that are in conversation primarily with some gigantic text or event from the past, you know, from the far distant past, the poet can feel so singular, you know, so alone. But in her collection, even though, of course, it's all written by her, and then the translation, of course, makes a different level with Robin's work as well. But that I always feel that she's, yeah, in this conversation with many other poets, many other thinkers, conversation against conversation with exploration, as she goes. And not just poets too, the other people that she mentions having talks with.
People in her family, her mother who passed away when she was very young, her father, former lovers, people from the small town that she's from, places. Yeah, there's, it just, it's very resonant. It's a great collection.
It's a really extraordinary collection, I think. Whether or not you're interested in poetry, if you're interested in words or Egypt, I would definitely recommend it.
Yeah. Yeah. What else did you read this summer that struck you?
Right. Well, so interestingly, another book that I read that is also coming out, this book is coming out in October in Robin Creswell's translation, Hadia Hussein's Waiting for the Past, which was actually Masayati, What's to Come, the sort of opposite in the original, but translated by Barbara Romaine, is also coming out in October. It was originally published in 2017. It's the second novel of Hadia's to come out in translation. The first was her 2003 novel, Beyond Love, but I really feel that she's developed so much as a novelist by the time we reach this. One of her short stories won the Arab Lit Story Prize in Şeker Mustafa's translation. And Şeker is, I believe, a good friend of Hadia's. She currently lives in Canada, but her also, much like Imen, another thing that's like Imen, but her sort of literary imagination is very much remains in Iraq. And this novel is set between 1990 and 2003. It's sort of pinned by these two points of invasion. And the main character, Narjis, we meet her as she is sort of fleeing her home in Baghdad, fleeing her husband, and also a notice that she's been told that she can't leave the city without informing the authorities, because her beloved, her lover, and was her fiance, was disappeared by the government, and she goes on a kind of this mission to hunt for him. But as she goes, we meet the other people. Who have also lost family, who and lovers and beloveds who are also looking in this secret way through these networks throughout Iraq, many of them Kurds, at least in this novel. I'm not suggesting I know anything about the real history of it. People who've been disappeared for all sorts of different reasons. There's this very compelling woman, Umhani, much of her family was disappeared because they had hemophilia and they contracted AIDS while they were receiving treatment, and the government wanted no one to know about this. So the everyone, her sons, were disappeared for having AIDS, and they were put in this guarded building, part of what's wonderful about this book is, it's paced really well, and you want to know what's happening with Narjis's relationship, and then all these, like, some of the characters are doing this out of great depth of humanity, a great personal risk, and then some of the characters who help her along the way are doing so out of monetary interest. But also, I just loved Narjis, who she's looking. She can't really tell people exactly what's going on with her, because she fled her husband, who she who's also gets a wonderful description because she got word that maybe her lover, who she had been in love with since childhood, her childhood sweetheart, was alive still after he'd been disappeared by the government, and. Presumably, apparently, it seems nobody knows, of course, why, but it seems that it was for talking about the novel The President by the Guatemalan writer Miguel Angel Asturias in a cafe, and making connections between that novel and the situation in Iraq, and, you know, everybody sort of, it says, rubbed their necks and one by one they slunk out of the coffee house. Then speaking to the last of them who was just about to leave, Yusuf said, his tone laced with sarcasm, "Cowards, the likes of you are the reason for the state we're in. One of them must have reported him," is what the friend of Narses is, who tells her. What we think, you know, we have to piece together what must have happened to Yusuf.
And so she's searching for him throughout the book?
She's searching for him after Iraq invades Kuwait and the country sort of blows up. You know, she kind of it's a dead end. She ends up living in Kurdistan with the family of one of the people, Kiki Tarik, who was helping her. I hope that I remember the name correctly, who was helping her on her search. And it's not until the sort of chaos, then sort of time elapses, you know, there's two main points in the novel are 1990 and 2003. Once there's another invasion, the invasion of the US, that's when sort of all these documents come out. And when people learn what happened to their loved ones, when, you know, people go in, you know, it just, she talks about it as like documents. Some were pilfered by Americans. Some people got and posted up on the streets. Some were for sale along the side of the road. In this depiction, anyway.
Does she find out anything? Does she at least find out that she? Okay,
she does. She does. But such a slim amount. Just. He was killed, not even how he was killed or what the sort of ruling is, but just like his name on a list of people who were killed at this prison. So she has some kind of closure, I guess. And then she goes back to Baghdad to try and sort of tell people what's happened or see what's going on. And then she goes back to Mutanebbi Street, which is where they're the friend that connected them, where they met, you know, in this bookshop. I mean, they met as children, but they hooked up. They had rendezvous at this bookshop.
Maybe you shouldn't give away too much, since it sounds suspenseful. And
I don't think I give away too much by saying she never finds Yusuf. I don't think we ever expect any miracles from the book. It's just beautifully told. I loved her character so much. And it was so difficult.
It makes me think a little bit of Hisham Matar's book, you know, the
yes.
Libyan American nonfiction story about trying to just find out what happened to his father with this like incredibly slim hope, somehow, again, not realistic that he somehow might be alive, but mostly assuming that he died in prison under Gaddafi and wanting to just know what happened to him.
Absolutely. It also reminded me of A Rare Blue Bird Flies With Me by Yusuf Fadil, as a woman in Morocco is searching for her loved one, and all the books by women who were searching for loved ones who were taken to Tazmamart. And also Dunya Makhail's in the slave markets, what was it called? The beekeeper. Yeah. Where women, you know, women were being smuggled out, and that was maybe more.
Which was about Yazidi women overwhelmingly women in this network of people trying to find them and track them down and reconnect them with their families.
And maybe it reminded me of that in part because I was, you know, so the book ends in 2003. And I was worried, you know, some of these characters that I met in northern Iraq, what happens to them after this?
I'll never forget, shortly after the invasion, a news article that I read that said that a rumor had spread in Baghdad that bodies of people who were disappeared had been basically mixed with the concrete of a bridge and disposed of that way. And that people went to the bridge and tore it apart, looking, thinking, and I think it was a false rumor. But it's just, stayed with me forever, that image.
Yes, this book is filled with this sort of desperation. Not even Umhani doesn't have any hope that any of her loved ones are still alive, you know. But she's searching for the body of her third son. That's what she wants. She has like a thin thread that she's following, that she wants a place to put her grief. And she, it's just so, so powerful, her desire to find, yes, even the remains.
Yeah, no, because it is a crime on top of a crime to disappear people rather than to execute them, you know, on a charge, which may be unjust, but to try and really erase their existence, like not let their families mourn them and not let their families ever move past their deaths by at least knowing the story of their deaths. It's absolutely unconscionable.
Mm. Yeah. And this is not just right. She's not ever married to him, Yusuf. They have no legitimate relationship with each other. But her life kind of freezes around this single moment of not knowing what happened to her childhood sweetheart. Because they when they pull her in for questioning and tell her that, you know, that the only reason they're not also jailing her is her mother is ill and, you know, it's sort of a terrifying experience in and of itself. They tell her that Yusuf ran away, so that there's, you know, she doesn't believe it, but she doesn't know what to believe either. And so when she gets this tiny slip of paper actually it goes to the bookseller on Motenebi Street, their shared friend, that says that Yusuf has not been devoured by wolves. He is still alive. She goes on this crazy journey just on this slim hope of figuring out what happened to him. This one person who she loved, you know, like I think it's like hard. If it was, you know, easy to then put your life back together, but it's so hard, you know, she ends up in this marrying her mother's best friend's son because her mom is dying of cancer and wants her to be settled, you know, as if having an unhappy marriage is somehow like going to look after her when her mom's gone. And it's just her life is so miserable. She wants back this thing that was taken from her. Anyway, I really enjoyed this book. I intend to read it again. It's out in October. Hadia Hussein's Waiting for the Past, translated by Barbara Romaine.
Cool. I'll have to check it out. And what else? I think you said there were a couple, or there was another book.
Yes. Okay. The other sort of book that I really felt sort of lit up inside while reading this summer was Mohammed Annaas's Bread on Uncle Miled's Table, which was the 2022 winner of the International Prize for Arabic Fiction. And I don't often feel that way about the books that have won the prize, but this book in particular, I do feel was extraordinary. And it was it was his debut novel.
Where is he from? Where is it set?
He's Libyan, and it is set between Tripoli and a village outside Tripoli. And he grows up between those two places. It is really an in-depth exploration of the character of this very unmasculine Libyan man and the pressures that people put on him of, you know, not just other men like his father, the drill sergeant when he's in the army, the Madonna, and his cousin in particular, but also the women around him. There's this remarkable scene where he's washing the dishes and he drops one and he cuts his hand and he can't stanch the flow of the bleeding. And he goes down to his mother's and he's like, "Can you help me? My hand is bleeding." And his mom is like, "Why were you doing the dishes? The dishes are your wife's work." You know, so he's like, he's bleeding. And instead she's criticizing his sort of lack of masculinity. And he's just such like a wonderful character and so funny. Like there's a suicide scene early on.
That's funny.
I'm sorry. He tries to kill himself several times.
There's a suicide scene that's funny.
He tries to kill himself several times. The first one is to me the funniest, but they're all funny. Sorry to say. He's like, he hangs himself and then he's on the chair ready to hang himself. And then he's like, shit. He's kind of a man. He loves his wife so much. He has a difficult relationship with her, as with everyone, because of this like super intense pressure to be masculine, which he does. You know, he grows up, his father owns a bakery and he grows up, this is the bread. He loves baking bread, and there's beautiful descriptions of baking. He also just loves taking care of his wife and cooking and taking care of the house and gardening. And
she's like, stop it. Stop all of that. Stop.
No, I think his wife, you know, appreciates many aspects of his personality, and she does love him. His cousin is like constantly like, they're spreading the word. He becomes this, there's this saying about an uncle Milad in the family, this sort of like maternal uncle who's weak. And his cousin is like, you know, the novel suggests that he's the reason for this saying. They're spreading this rumor that he's just, you know, and his cousin's like, take this belt, you need to beat your wife. And so there's just so much pressure on him to become, but as he's standing on the chair, he starts to imagine his wife having to clean up the mess that he makes after he kills himself. And then he wants to get down, but he instead steps off the chair, which, you know, has the effect of, you know, really killing yourself. But so he's struggling to get out of the noose. And then he's imagining, you know, a shot of his legs, like on an Egyptian film. I don't know. It was so like, the whole novel is so grim and sad and funny all at the same time. And the ending, which I wrote a review of this, and it was such a struggle not to say anything, to give any hint of the ending. But I think it's extremely powerful. People will not it won't appeal to everyone. It's not a happily ever after. But I found the novel, I couldn't stop reading it. And I also do a reader's report for it, and I've been told that an offer has been made on the book to translate it to English, which I'm excited about.
So for now, it's only available in Arabic.
Yes. But I think, I don't know, I can't imagine why he would turn down the offer. So then it has to be translated. So it'll take some time.
But so let me just ask, and the reason that he is suicidal is because of this like endless social pressure and like non-acceptance of him as a person.
Right. So he probably would have had issues with depressions and in depression in any case. But the sort of the central driver that is pushing him over the edge in every instance where he does attempt suicide, which are several, is this push to extreme masculinity. You know, his father's dying wish is that he do his military service. And El Madonna, the military drill sergeant, I don't know what the word for that is in English, but the guy who's there with to break in the new recruits, really, you know, he immediately sees, he can see Milad is like this sort of, you know, feminized, weak, I don't know. He's not weak in the sense, you know, he has so many strengths, but, you know, he's out of place. He doesn't fit the sort of masculine ideal. He targets him immediately. And the things that he puts him through are just, you know, awful.
That's such an interesting topic. I don't think I've ever read a book that explores this, and which is definitely a social phenomenon, the like huge pressure to perform a very narrow band of masculinity.
Right. So the one thing it reminded me of was Reda Semen's, what is it called? Beheading the Cat, something like that. Because that is around, I think it triggered this memory because He also refers to, they in Libya, I guess they have a similar, each chapter opens with kind of a saying about masculinity, and they have a saying, must be similar one to a saying in Lebanon, about you have to, you know, behead a cat on the first night of your wedding, I think, you know, as right after you're married, to, you know, basically scare your wife into obedience.
Right, into submission, yeah. Huh.
So Ghedis Amen has this male character who's, you know, he's living in Europe and, you know, trying to explore what, you know, what is masculinity? How is he supposed to be a man? So that reminds, but yes, I think it is unusual. And Imen Homaiden, who was one of the judges for the International Prize for Arabic Fiction, she did kind of remark on that she, you know, that was one of the reasons why they found it remarkable.
Huh. Well, I'm happy that they gave it the award, that they saw its originality. And also it sounds like tonally, like that it's hard to pull off what you're describing in terms of the narrative style, like this, you know, to tell a story that's this grim in a way that's sort of humorous, or with a voice, with a narrator's voice that's
right,
that's humorous. Like that's
funny and charming.
That's a really hard thing to do. I'm always very impressed when I come across books that do that.
Yeah, I was, yeah. I mean, and just his sense of timing is excellent. We're dealing with a lot of narrative threads from different points in his life, but I never felt, I did see some people on social media claiming that they felt confused about who is he telling the story to. I never felt confused about where we were in space and time or what was happening. And what about, Ursula, your summer in books? What were sort of the extraordinary highlights?
I mean, I didn't actually read for work, or even, it feels like, read that much. There was a lot of travel and a lot of family and a lot of optimistically carrying books around, which is also nice.
Yeah.
I read a book by Albert Memmi, the Tunisian writer, that I had been meaning to read ever since we did an episode on him. It's his Portrait of the Colonizer and the Colonized, which is very good. But then that's sort of related actually to the literary field that Bulak focuses on. I didn't read that much. I went home to California, and I have this, you know, burgeoning interest in the Lebanese American great poet and painter Etel Adnan, who passed away recently, and I had found out that because she lived in California for quite a significant portion of her life, some of her papers ended up at this special archive at Berkeley. So I went up there and spent a day in this very quiet, slightly over the top library room where the librarians would actually come by and like comment on like how many folders you had out at a time and sort of tell you to put them back in order in the box. They were really
wow.
Serious. Yeah, I mean, to a degree that, because it was like several boxes of papers that had been donated by her collaborator and companion Simone Fatal to create this little collection, and so there were like press clippings and interviews with her, which was interesting. But those are not like, you know, those aren't rare documents. They're literally photocopies. But then what there was, which was actually moving, I think, which is always sort of exciting, is several poems written, several first drafts of poems written in her hand.
Mm, right.
And when you get that, you get a little, a little shock of excitement to see like these first drafts. And you almost see a writer's personality sometimes in their handwriting. Hers is very, it sort of feels like it has a lot of momentum. It's always kind of going from the left corner up to the right corner and line after line, and kind of messy, like lots of corrections. So that was exciting. And I read there for a day, and I also like took a lot of photocopies and pictures, because I couldn't read everything. So I haven't really processed it all. But it was nice. I've been reading her poetry recently. At some point, I think it would be great to do an episode all about her. It's just that her body of work is so big and significant that I don't feel like I'm there yet. But one of the poems that I read is one that I was then unable to find online or figure out where it was published. And the first line is "To be a woman in America." And it's like a 22-page poem that feels written by a young woman who's emigrated to America. And I found it very interesting. That was a highlight. And other than that, our common friend, Yasmin Arifai, the Egyptian writer, her book that I've been looking forward to for many years now, is coming out this fall, and that's Radius, A Story of Feminist Revolution. It's not fiction. It's about, as you know, the attacks on female protesters and then the counter movement among protesters to protect them in the crowds following the Arab Spring, which I think is just an incredibly, so it's like an oral history and an essay. I'm really looking forward to reading the final version of this book, and I think it's a really important story, and Yasmin is the person to tell it. So I think that's something that we'll be discussing in a later episode.
And she being the person to tell it, both because she is an excellent writer and because she was right in the middle of the movement and of making these decisions about the movement.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, it's history that she participated in and that raises all these like incredibly thorny questions, about revolutionary moments, about sexual violence, about women's activism. I think it's such a sort of troubling, and also like because the attacks were so awful, but then the courage of the people who were organizing to keep the squares where women wanted to continue to protest alongside men safe, their courage was so extraordinary. So there's like light and dark in this story, I'm really looking forward to that book. And then I think we're also looking forward to Bushra al-Makhtari's What Have You Left Behind, translated by Savad Hussein, which I don't know if you had a chance to read, if you've gotten an advanced copy. I haven't, but...
I haven't either. I've seen there have been two excerpts in The Guardian and N+1. And I've read those, but I'm still waiting on my on my copy. But I think it will be out in October, I think, or September this month. No, I think it will be out next month.
And this is also an oral history of it's based on hundreds of interviews with Yemenis on both sides of the Yemeni civil war and conflict in recent years. And that's pretty much all I know about it.
Savad has talked about how traumatizing it was to translate as a book, to sort of engage. I mean, it must have also been, I guess Bushra talks about it differently as a way of sort of reclaiming her agency in a very difficult, dire, frightening, depressing situation. Savad talks about it as, sort of deeply engaging in this very traumatic thing. And in these traumatic sort of civilian accounts of war in Yemen. And I think that this is something that translators don't often talk about is what it means to translate traumatic works.
Right. I mean, because the question around a book like this is also, what does it mean to write it and to read it? Like what does this basically kind of testimony or kind of witnessing do? What is its purpose? I think hopefully we'll have Savad on to talk about this. I think we both believe in the fact that telling one's story and sort of saving people's stories does something, gives some degree of meaning and dignity and truth and, you know, relief sometimes, but not always. I mean, you know, one can't also like exaggerate the powers of these narratives, and so I think it's also about how it's done, and I think it's been done very well in this case. This is another book that hopefully we'll be talking about soon.
Yes, I look forward to that.
Yeah, me too. And I think we're going to stop here for today. It's been a pleasure recording again for our listeners, and we're happy to be back. And we are excited for this next season. I hope everybody has like a good end of the summer, beginning of the school year, transition. And we'll be back soon.
Yes. It was great talking to you, Ursula.
Yeah, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.